So either I'm getting sick, or after I spent the last 2 days cleaning my garage, which I do once a year whether it needs it or not, I sucked in too much dust. It really could be either one. You haven't seen my garage, but it's looking good now. Till next year. So this past week, our country, we lost someone who became known as America's grandmother. You know, and it's interesting, and I did a little bit of looking, and I found some articles, and people that were close to Barbara Bush really overall spoke pretty highly of her. And I was young when George H.W. Bush was president, and so I didn't have a real good idea as to who she was and what kind of things she even stood for. But I did some looking, and I came across a few things, and it kind of speaks to where we want to go here this morning. And I wanted to share a couple of things that I've learned and found out here. So when George and Barbara Bush were engaged, he was a bit of a wordsmith, I guess, and he wrote her all kinds of letters over the years. And on the day that they were engaged, this is what George H.W. wrote to her. He says, "I love you, precious." I know, it's so sweet. It's hard to envision the president of the United States, you know, ever talking like this, but apparently he did at one point. And he says, "I love you, precious, with all my heart." He's not talking about the little gold ring. Okay, this is different. So if that's where your mind went, I'm sorry for your nerdity. Okay. So he says, "I love you, precious, with all my heart, and to know that you love me means my life. How often I have thought about the immeasurable joy that will be ours someday." And I look at this idea of this immeasurable joy, and he lays it out that there's this anticipation for something that's coming. And what they didn't know, and this would have been after this, because I believe they were engaged. They met when she was 16, he was 17. A year and a half later, they got engaged, and then he went shortly thereafter off to fight in World War II. And he was shot down over the Pacific. And so there was a month where she hadn't heard anything from him, and you couldn't help but wonder, here she is with this letter that she received at their engagement, and she's looking at this letter and sees these words, "this immeasurable joy that will be ours someday," and can't help but go like, maybe, maybe not. You know, and it leaves you, you can enter into a little bit of that grief, a little bit of that pain that she would have been enduring at that time. And then later on, there's in one of these other letters, they took a bunch of these letters, and I guess they've published them. This first quote is from one of those letters, and it says, George again, writing to Barbara, and says, "You have given me joy that few men know." And then to an interviewer, this is the statement that George H.W. Bush says to his interviewer, he says, "I have climbed perhaps the highest mountain in the world," referring to his presidency. You know, just here he is. What a lofty position that he's in. But even that cannot hold a candle to being Barbara's husband. You know, and you see there's this connection that they have. It's a pretty powerful connection. And there's something going on with that, and there's certainly a joy that's been experienced with this, and I'm not saying that that's a divine joy in any capacity. However, we do get this picture of this grief and joy kind of in the mix and anticipating one while experiencing the other. There's a poet by the name of Khalil Gibran. I'm 50% sure I'm saying that name right. Only 50%. And what did you say it was, Pam? Sure. Anyway, and I'm pretty certain that he is what would be considered a universalist. And so I'm going to share this quote with the understanding that this is from a universalist, meaning that any and all religions that kind of blend together, okay? But I will say he's making this point on this idea of joy that's very intriguing, and I think we'd do well to at least look at it because there's a few pieces there. It's like, wow, he's making a fairly interesting, valid point. So let's look at this quote by what Pam said. It says, "When you are joyous, look deep into your heart, and you shall find it is only that which has given you sorrow that is giving you joy. When you are sorrowful, look again in your heart, and you shall see that in truth you are weeping for that which has been your delight." So here's this idea, and he raised up this fascinating thought. Can you really, in some capacity, experience joy without having sorrow, or experience sorrow without having joy? They kind of, in a sense, go hand in hand. An example might be, like, let's say, hypothetically, one or two of you are Vikings fans in the room. And let's just say hypothetically you got tickets to the NFC Championship game in Philadelphia. And let's just say you're the only one there, okay? And you watch your beloved Vikings lose while everyone else is, in a sense, celebrating around you. You stand alone and they've lost. You know, there's this idea in the midst of what's going on there. Here you are standing alone experiencing this idea of grief. And maybe even a more poignant example would be in this, it's what Khalil is Khalil, whatever you said, is saying, is there's this idea, unless I have loved someone, I can't experience the sorrow for losing them. You kind of follow? You know, so if you have lost a loved one, you've lost a spouse, you've lost a child, you've lost a parent, you experience the sorrow because you have already experienced the joy. You follow with where he's kind of going at with that? It's an interesting piece, and we're going to see that's going to pull us into where we're going at today. We've been going through the Gospel of John. We left off last week where Jesus was interacting still again with his disciples, and he talked about this Holy Spirit again. This Holy Spirit is going to come, and he's going to bring this idea of conviction. He's going to bring this, he's going to show the world, reveal the world its guilt in their sin. He's going to reveal to the world righteousness, how they're guilty of unrighteousness, and yet Jesus is righteous. And Jesus proves that he is righteous by the fact that he lived his life. He died, buried, his life came back to life, and then went on to live again, basically saying, you guys killed me because you called me unrighteous. And because he was righteous, he had no choice but to raise from the grave, and we saw the proof in that. And people then looked at him as like, well, okay, this is this guy. We called him unrighteous. He died. He is alive again now. I guess we were wrong, and he was right. And so we're faced with this decision. Is Jesus really who he says he is? And then we went through in this discourse that he's been going on through the upper room. This is the point where he had shared with Peter, you will deny me. He shared with Judas that you will betray me. He shared with his disciples, you guys will be scattered. We talked a few weeks ago. He says, I am the true vine. I'm that which Israel was, in a sense, positioned to be, connected with me so well, and yet they did not do that. But I am the true vine. I'm rooted in the Father. The Father is, and I are, in a sense, one. And then you are my branches. You are grafted into me. And if you abide in me, then you will bear much fruit. And so we've been working through this. These are all the things that Jesus has been saying to his disciples. And we're coming up in the end of this discourse. This is his final message to his disciples. There's 11 of them left. Judas has already left. It's his final message, and we come to this kind of closing point. We're probably going to take it in 2 weeks, okay, this week and then in 2 weeks from now. And he comes up, and he starts it off here then for us. We left off last week in verse 15. We're up in verse 16. It says, Jesus went on to say, and he says, in a little while you will see me no more, and then after a little while you will see me. This idea, I know it seems a little bit vague, it seems confusing. We're going to break it down, we're going to get some understanding on it. But this idea of little while, that phrase is going to occur 7 times in the next 4 verses. And when we look at why that is and what the significance of that is, what we're seeing is there's this strong emphasis in this idea of it's going to be a very short time. The Greek is really this redundancy that you find in that language. Basically, it's all pointing down to this fact of, guess what, guys? Something's coming, and it's coming quick, is really what Jesus is getting at. And certainly, he lays out this confusing, in a little while you will see me no more, and then after a little while you will see me. And the disciples are confused by that, and in some sense, rightly so. But there's this confusion of, like, what is a little while? You know, if my kids ask me, Dad, can I have a snack? Yeah, in a little while. Well, what does that mean? 5 minutes? 30 minutes? 30 hours? You know, if my daughter came and said, Dad, this boy asked me to the movie, can I go? No. There's no little while. Okay. There's just, little while doesn't exist in that setting. That's not happening. And so what we see is there's this confusion. Okay, they don't understand what is a little while, and what does he mean he's going and coming back? Okay? And so the disciples are going to take some matters in their own hands. So it says, at this time, some of the disciples said to one another, I find it fascinating that they're saying this to one another when Jesus is the one that has shared it with them. They're not saying, Jesus, what do you mean that you're going to go in a little while and then come back in a little while? What are you getting at? But instead, they bypass Jesus, the source of the information. It's just an interesting point, and they decide to talk to themselves then instead. So at this, some of the disciples said to one another, you know, I should sing with this voice. You know, I'd be a bass today. It just makes you want to try it. You know, if we could form a barbershop quartet in the next 5 minutes, I'd give it a whirl. Okay. So it says, what does he mean by saying, in a little while? So they're asking themselves, what does he mean? What is this little while? How long of a period of time is this? And why is he going? Why is he coming back? We're not getting our minds around this. So it says, in a little while you will see me, and then because after a little while you will not see me again. And because I am going to the Father, they kept asking, what does he mean by a little while? Is this just going to be a little 5-minute thing? We don't understand. What is it that he is saying? And then so Jesus, I love this, Jesus saw. Okay, visually he saw, he recognized, he saw the signs for it. You know, and Jesus is God. We recognize that. We've gone through this over and over and over again. We believe that Jesus is who he says he is, and he says he is the Son of God. And in John chapter 8, we see him even point to the fact that even before Abraham was, I am. And so we believe fully that Jesus is God. And so there is this divine ability that he has to discern these things. But it says Jesus saw that they wanted to ask him about this. So before they even have a chance to ask him, he's going to go and answer their question. That's going to prove important as we go on through this chapter. He says, are you asking one another what I meant when I said, in a little while, you will see me no more, and then after a little while, you will see me? There's that redundancy that goes over and over and over again, really emphasizing the fact that this is going to happen, and it's going to happen quickly. Okay? And I think the disciples' answer to that question would be, yes. That's exactly what we were asking ourselves. We did not know what you meant by you're going to be gone for a little while and then you're going to come back, etc. So in verse 20, now it says, very truly, and we've seen this phrase in the gospel a lot. And really what's going on with this idea of very truly, and we kind of bypass it, but in the original language, it would be the equivalent of like saying, amen, amen. In other words, this is so. It's preceding something that Jesus is going to lay out for them. It's like, you can, in a sense, take this to the bank. What I'm about to tell you is so rock solid certain, there will be no question about it. And so we have to look at that and understand that, okay, what's about to follow is so important that the disciples understand not only that Jesus is saying it, but that they understand that it is absolutely rock solid true. And he's going to lay this out. Watch what he says. He says, very truly I tell you, you will weep and you will mourn. Remember just a few weeks ago, we were talking about Jesus was telling his disciples, oh, by the way, guys, the entire world is going to hate you. And they're going to hate you because they hated me first. And so you have that to look forward to, you know, which is nice. So as you go throughout this world, the world is going to hate you. You've got to understand that you and the world do not match, okay? What you believe and what they believe, they're in constant conflict with each other. And you will be hated for the fact that you believe in me. And we see it in our culture. I mean, we don't see it anywhere near like we see it in other cultures. And some of the statistics show that right now in this day and age, maybe we don't experience it here like others do in other areas of the world, but this world is under more persecution. Christians are under more persecution now today than they ever have been in the history of the world. And that's amazing when you look at some of the ways that Christians have been persecuted, you know, over time. And it's including the Jews, which would not necessarily be Christians, but even the Holocaust, that kind of persecution. And this is above that. So he said, very truly, I will tell you, you are going to weep and you're going to mourn while the world rejoices. This is that idea. Sitting in a Vikings game, your team is losing, and all around you are in the midst of the enemy. They're all celebrating the touchdown, and here you are mourning the loss. You know? And that doesn't really do it quite justice, because the reality would be this way. We talked about losing a loved one. And this sounds so harsh, but try to put yourself into this position. Try to put yourself into this imagery. You have a child that you've lost. You have a parent that you've lost. You have a really close friend, perhaps, that you've lost. They've died. And now you're in the midst. You're in the memorial service. You're the only one that's mourning while everyone else around you is literally rejoicing at the fact that your loved one is dead. That's in a sense, that's what Jesus is telling them. You guys are going to be mourning. And the word mourn here is absolutely 100% locked in with this idea of associating with death. So what Jesus is telling him, you guys are going to mourn because you're going to lose someone closely. That's the word that we're looking at. It's not just, you're not just going to be sad because you lost your nickel, okay? He's laying out this idea of you are going to mourn the death of a loved one while everyone around you is celebrating that person that you're mourning over is dead. I mean, what a contrast. Could you imagine how you would feel. Can you imagine what that would be like to be in the midst of a situation where you're heartbroken and you're struggling because you have suffered such a great, deep, painful loss, and yet everyone around you is going, yes, I'm so glad that person is dead. And that's the situation we find ourselves in this morning. It says, you will grieve. But this is what, so that deep pain that he's talking about, the deep pain that he's raising up to the surface there, that grief will turn to joy. Talk about a confusing statement, though. You know, to have that kind of a deep, painful situation where everyone around you, you know, and I struggle to kind of go back to the sports realm. I'm going to do it here just briefly because if this just last year, those Vikings fans who watched the New Orleans Saints and Vikings game, okay, we were all ready for the loss, were we not? All right? I was already beginning to mourn the loss against the Saints, all right? And then just like that, that grief turned to joy, that mourning was gone. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it just was instantaneous. It was just like jaw-dropping, and that's just sports, okay? And so I feel a little bit bad equating it that way, but it gives you a little bit of a picture how quickly it can turn, and that's what we're going to see here. There will be this season of mourning that they're going to be experiencing, but it is promised that it's only going to last a day. And then he gives, perhaps, this is maybe the metaphor that he uses that I like above any others. He uses this metaphor. And I wrote about this yesterday in the email and in the blog, if you happen to read it. So in John 16, verse 21, he gives this metaphor. He says, a woman giving birth to a child has pain because her time has come. But when her baby is born, she forgets the anguish because of her joy that the child is born into the world. That maybe is the most perfect illustration. I wrote about this yesterday, this idea of Sarah had long labor experiences. Hannah was like pushing 36 hours. You know, do you know how hard that is on me? Any idea? The lack of sleep. And then Isaac was the quickest one. He was like only 13 hours. And then Carissa was a long one. That was an overnight one. You know, I know I said this before, I had to sleep in a recliner. And then we had to wake up. And then the next day, I constantly have to rubbing her back while my cheeseburger is getting cold. It was absolutely miserable. But there's this point, and I know everyone's laughing, but there's this point, and I do want to emphasize this. And this has always confused me, and I wrote about this yesterday, but it's always confused me, but it's 100% true for her. And she always shares this truth. She would make the statement, I mean, I just was there, I watched what happened, okay? And I don't think my pain was as bad as hers. It's close. At times it was close. I had to peel her claws out of my arm. That's not true. That's not true. She cut her nails first. But she brings up this point, and she always says, oh, I love birthing babies. I'm thinking, seriously? I've been there all four times, okay? And it's like, that's not really the word that I would use to describe what I just witnessed, you know? Because there is lots of yelling, and there's lots of screaming going on, and some of it's hers. But here's this reality, and this is so true. She says, I love birthing babies. She says, at that moment when it's done, and they take the child and put it in my arms, she said, it's all worth it. She describes it, says, I love that moment. I love that moment. You know, so it's worth all of the pain leading up to it. You know, and Erica, our fourthborn, she was 9 days overdue, and we're walking and walking, and Sarah's like, I just want to have the baby. And there's just, and that's not the pain type thing, but this is anguish that just keeps coming, and you wonder the longer it's in there, is it going to be okay? Over and over and over again, and yet still at that moment then, when she has the baby, she holds the baby, it's always just like, that's the moment that I live for. You know, and that's the picture that Jesus is really laying out here. You can have all of this pain, even hours, 36 hours or more, okay? All of this laboring, all of this work, all of this grief. And Jesus says that that's what it's like, but yet you guys are going to experience this mourning, you're going to experience this grief, but when that joy comes at the end of it, you're going to blow your mind with what it is that you're experiencing. And so then he goes on. This is the last verse. We're going to kind of wrap it up here. So it was originally much longer, but I cut it down. J.R.R. Tolkien, for you, those who went, whose mind went right when you saw the word precious, you went to the ring. You'll appreciate this too. Tolkien uses a phrase. He uses a phrase. He kind of coined the word, in fact, and it's eucatastrophe. And a eucatastrophe, according to Tolkien, is this idea that in the midst of all of the junk, all of the catastrophe of life, all the chaos of life, you find this, in a sense, beacon of joy that exists in the midst of it. You know, and that's what we're seeing here. And he uses that term even in describing what we're talking about here, where even in the midst of, Jesus is about ready to die, suffer and die, and carry the burden, the weight of the sin of the world on his shoulders. As all of this is ready to happen, he says it's a eucatastrophe, because even in the midst of all of that pain, here you have this joy that's about ready to spring up in the midst of it. And it's a great idea. It's a great thought. It's a great word. So in verse 22 now, I love how he's going to conclude this piece for us. He says, so with you now, you disciples, you 11 who are still with me, it is so with you. You are experiencing mourning. You are experiencing grief. And this has even happened now. And what's fascinating is this would have been for the Jews as well. At this time, they would have been experiencing these labor pains, and they didn't even realize that they were in labor. You know what I'm saying? You know, they're experiencing all the same stuff in a sense that the disciples are. There's this grief. They're under Roman oppression. And yet, what they're experiencing, they don't have a clue as to the joy that's about ready to spring up. They don't even know they're pregnant, in a way. You understand? And so he says it to the disciples. In other words, you guys understand this, and I don't want you to miss this. This is that very truly point here. He says, so with you, now is your time of grief. But he says, look at that. He changes the pronoun here. He says, but I will see you again. And Jesus is promising this is going to be a very physical resurrection. I will see you. You're not just going to see me dead laying in a tomb, but I will see you again. That's the promise. And so even in the midst of this grief, this mourning, that is everything's pointing to death, he says, I will see you again. And look at this, and you will rejoice, and no one will take away your joy. And that's the piece right there. The disciples' joy, listen to this. The disciples' joy, it's entirely contingent. It's totally dependent on the relationship that they have with Jesus. Now, I want you to understand that. Because here's this thing. We all have this connection with each other, whether we recognize it or not. Whether you are a follower of Christ or you are not a follower of Christ, we all have this connection that in this life you experience suffering. You experience brokenness. You know, we have pain. Not just when we slam our finger in the door, but we have pain. We have emotional pain. Okay? Physical pain. We hurt when someone near us dies. We understand what brokenness is really well. But where we struggle is, where is the joy on the other side? And that's where I feel that it can only come when we come to this understanding of, that our joy is 100% totally dependent. We can have happiness, okay? That's all dealing with happenings. But this idea of joy, which is what Jesus is talking about here, this joy that even in the midst of my suffering, I can see that there's this joy that is ready to spring up forth, is so dependent, 100% dependent on our relationship with Jesus. If you remember back to when we talked about the vine, and Jesus says, I am the true vine, and you guys are the branches. If you abide in me, you will bear much fruit. You know, the fruit of the Spirit. Love, peace, joy. You see, if we're not connected with the vine, it'll just be suffering. But if we're connected with the vine, that suffering will turn to joy. It'll be a eucatastrophe. And in the midst of our pain, in the midst of our brokenness, that we can share together and uplift each other in it. Because when we can suffer, I mean, because we do, every one of you has an opportunity to share in the suffering of someone else. You can relate. You've lost a loved one, you can relate to someone else in the room. You've lost a job, you can relate to someone else in the room. You smash your finger in a door, I guarantee you others have smashed their finger in the door. Right? Yeah, all kinds of hands are going up. Yeah, I did that. I don't want you to miss this reality, because we look at joy and we think that, you know, followers of Christ, oh, we should always be joyful. In a sense, yes. Okay? There is some truth to that. But that doesn't diminish the fact that we will have seasons of grief. There will come seasons of grief. But in the midst of the seasons of grief, we can look at it as a eucatastrophe. It's like, yep, there's this catastrophe going on, but in the midst of it, I know where I'm at because I have this relationship with Jesus Christ. And in that relationship, I will abide in him. He's going to bear much fruit through this. Maybe he'll even use my catastrophe to bless someone else. So I'm going to invite Dave and the worship team back up. And I want us to worship. I want us to celebrate. I want us to be joyous. But in the midst of it, I don't want us to lose sight of what has brought us the joy. And because even in the midst of some of our sufferings, we find that Jesus is using our sufferings to bring up a greater joy, maybe in ourselves, but then also maybe in others.